So welcome everybody. I'm glad to see that many faces. Today we have a special day in the Zukunftskolleg and with the Martin Buber Society. The Martin Buber Society is also an institution that has fellows for doing independent research. So in many ways we are sisters and brothers, and we are also connected by a long history of joint events and a history also of equal values in how to promote research and early in a research career. Now, since a few years, we have done joint workshops that work by having a part of the workshop in Konstanz and a part of the workshop in Jerusalem. And that workshop has started today here in Konstanz and will go on the whole day tomorrow and Saturday morning. We thought that having a workshop without a big party is something a little bit sad, and that is why after this talk we will have a big party. And I'm very glad that Wolfgang Seibel will be at the party. But as you see, I'm starting from the back. Yeah. So be with me at the party, but I'm unfortunately only at the beginning. But that is important and also helpful, and I'm glad about that, because that opens the possibility of asking questions and going more into detail in the discussion. Now, before you have that treat, we have this other treat, which is your talk. I'm very glad that you will help us in our topic of certainty, uncertainty. Let me say a few words about Wolfgang Seibel. He is professor here at the university. He has just received a big grant of the German Research Foundation, a COSELEC project, which is something quite prestigious. He is a permanent fellow at the Kulturwissenschaftskolleg here in Konstanz. And he is in the academic committee of the Buber Society. So if some of the fellows in the Buber Society think about who selected them, how did they get to go there? Well, you have one of the faces right here. Again, thank you very much for being part of this workshop, and I'll leave the stage to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Galizia. I'm really glad to be here. I really gladly accepted the invitation. When I was asked to if I could be willing to give a talk at this particular occasion, I hope this will work. And actually, uncertainty is not really one of my specific research purposes, but it does play a role. Quite obviously, in my particular field, which is politics and public administration. So there is a broad strand of literature about how to cope with uncertainty in organization science. And, coping with uncertainty is basically part and parcel of politics in general. However, the topic of my talk is not uncertainty as such, but it is about intended uncertainty. And I can't say I never thought systematically about intended uncertainty before actually I did prepare this talk. So I hope it's more than kind of provisorial thinking or improvised talk. So I brought a manuscript, which is already a certain guarantee that it is slightly more systematic than it could have been in my case. And with the help of Luisa Focke, who is sitting here right in front of me, we managed to go through a series of slides as well. So I'm confident we manage the coordination. So a slight degree of unintended uncertainty comes with the organization of the talk. So the subtitle is moral and institutional issues, and I will try to address this in more detail in the remainder, in the real corpus of the talk. The notion and reality of uncertainty concerns both the past and the future. As far as the past is concerned, it is about constrained interpretability. As far as the future is concerned, it is about constrained predictability. Intended uncertainty may again become salient in two different ways. Uncertainty may be purposefully created or purposefully sustained or exploited. In what follows, I will address the four basic types of intended uncertainty that result from these basic categories. In the second part of my talk, I will attempt to explain why various types of intended uncertainty imply various configurations of institutionalization and legitimacy. In the third and final part, I will discuss the various degrees of legitimacy as an ambivalent phenomenon in its own right. And I will conclude with an emphasis on judgment and leadership as far as acceptable and unacceptable types of intended uncertainty are concerned. The judgment, I'm stating, affects the nature of risks connected to purposefully created or exploited uncertainty, as well as the consequences for moral and institutional integrity. Let me give you a step-by-step illustration of purposefully created and purposefully sustained or exploited interpretability constraints and predictability constraints, thus the four basic categories I just mentioned and that you see being depicted on the screen. It's a little bit, it's more light and blurry than I expected, but nonetheless, I think we will handle this. There are indeed typical patterns of purposefully created uncertainty of the past, which is, by the way, the title of an often quoted article by organization theorists James March and Johan Olsen of 1975 about the pitfalls of organizational learning. This is about unintended uncertainty, however, and it is also about a particular structural setting, namely formal organizations. A much more common phenomenon, one in the realm of politics and democracy, that we don't automatically associate with the notion of uncertainty, at least not intended uncertainty, is the secret ballot. Unlike what conventional wisdom tells, its purpose is not only to guarantee the unfettered freedom of voting itself, but also to leave the elected officials in a state of uncertainty to whom exactly they ultimately owe their respective mandate or office. And this is, in turn, the crucial mechanism that strengthens the commitment to the general public interest and thus a protection against clientelism. Needless to say, the party system dilutes this mechanism, but in principle, every candidate running for office automatically pays tribute to the intended uncertainty of past voting through trying to appeal to as many indistinct voters as possible, while every sitting elected official automatically pays tribute to the uncertainty of past voting through taking into account the impact of his or her decisions and omissions on citizens of indistinct numbers and walks of life. The next example is a classic example, which is privacy protection. This also is about purposefully created interpretability constraints, and again it is related to the institutionalization of democratic principles. Governmental agencies have to remain ignorant, thus uncertain, about what individual citizens actually do and don't, often despite a basic public interest in certainty about, say, the origins of crimes, or just in the necessity of effective coordination of various public agencies. Privacy protection is, in a way, the epitome of purposefully created interpretability constraints at the expenses of public authorities, but to the benefit of individual citizens. Another classic example is negotiations. They work only when conducted behind the proverbial closed doors. The reason is that negotiating means to seek compromises, and compromises imply concessions. Making concessions visible while negotiations are still on the way would make negotiation partners losing face. It would thus paralyze negotiations altogether, which is, by the way, a prominent reason why so many negotiations do fail. So negotiations on the basis of purposefully created interpretability constraints might even be the best example of why intended uncertainty is not just a necessary evil, but sometimes at least an indispensable prerequisite of political achievements that otherwise would be out of reach. Yet another less attractive illustration of a quite ubiquitous phenomenon of interpretability constraints that are purposefully created is myth building. Unlike usual and usually indispensable sense making, myth building is typically out of touch with reality. The function of myth building is not making sense of empirical evidence, but creating narratives regardless of evidence. What counts is the narrative itself, while facts and figures not only don't count, but might be even be rejected by true believers as heresy. Which brings me to one of the most appalling examples of intended uncertainty in the form of purposefully created interpretability constraints, which is forced disappearance. It was invented in its modern form by Nazi Germany in December 1941 with a decree known as Nacht- und Nebelerlass, which in a literal sense would have to be translated into something like Decree of Night and Fog, an allusion to the fact that the decree, signed by Hitler himself, instructed German military authorities in the occupied territories throughout Europe to arrest civilians, especially, quote, communist elements and otherwise anti-German circles, unquote. That happened with the explicit purpose to cause terror and fear through, as a subsequent decree put it, the, quote, traceless disappearance, in German, spurloses Verschwinden lassen. Today, forced disappearance is defined as a crime against humanity, according to the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearance, adopted by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 2006. So we do have, obviously, benign and malign versions of intended uncertainty in the form of purposefully created interpretability constraints. In many instances, however, interpretability constraints do just exist, regardless of whether they have been created long time ago or whether they are an inevitable phenomenon of human interaction under particular circumstances or conditions. This is, consequently, the second category of intended uncertainty I would like to address. The difference between purposefully created and purposefully sustained or exploited interpretability constraints is obvious in the case of sense-making versus myth-building I just mentioned. Individual and collective sense-making is a generic social phenomenon whose importance, however, increases with the degree of uncertainty in the form of ambiguity. In all kinds of collectivities, sense-making is a matter of both identity or integration and pragmatic coordination. Whether it is about who we are or about what are we supposed to do, sense-making is an indispensable response to uncertainty about one's role and position and about real-world challenges. Myth-building, by contrast, might be a forceful identity builder, but, like I said, is not concerned with reality and, needless to say, there are more or less attractive active sense makers, actors who are more or less apt and motivated to discover and to exploit ambiguity under the condition of interpretability constraints. It is also obvious, however, that the difference between sense making and myth building is blurry. And it is self-evident that the more apt and capable actors are to exploit these zones of uncertainty, the more motivated they are to keep them intact, so that the difference between purposefully sustained and purposefully created zones of uncertainty is blurry as well. In my own field, political science and public administration, there are broad strands of literature on this kind of active exploitation of interpretability constraints other than sense-making, although sense-making in organizations is a prominent subfield. Primarily concern this kind of literature, leadership behavior in politics and formal organizations. For instance, uncertainty about past events creates a permissive environment for blame avoidance strategy. This, it wasn't us, it was them, or It wasn't me, it was the circumstances are the classic rhetorical patterns connected to blame avoidance. And as a matter of fact, there are more or less permissive conditions, rather facilitating or rather restricting the leeway for avoidance strategies when it comes to the question of whom to hold accountable, especially when something went wrong. More fragmented and multi-layered organizational structures, for example, create more of such leeway than unitary and strictly hierarchized organizations. By the same token, a different strand of literature emphasizes zones of uncertainty in organizations in the form of information asymmetries between leading personnel and rank-and-file employees, known as the principal-agent problem. While the blame avoidance literature emphasizes the inclination of leaders in organizations not to be held accountable for the decisions or omissions, the principal agent literature emphasizes the eagerness of leaders to be acknowledged as the responsible key players who are being held accountable anyway. Nonetheless, they too are exposed to interpretability constraints. Principal agent theory supposes, however, that these constraints work to the detriment of principals and in favor of the quote-unquote agents, the rank-and-file employees, since it is them, the people in the deep belly of the organization, who are in control of significant of information which make them inclined to outmaneuver their superiors. This is known as the moral hazard problem. It is a moral issue, since rank-and-file employees should be honest and loyal to their superiors, and it is a hazard, since information that is being withheld might be indispensable for the survival of the organization for which the leadership is ultimately responsible. Conventional principal-agent theory is, however, based on the heroic assumption that leaders in organizations are always interested in full information in order to be fully in control. But this is not necessarily the case, at least not under certainty, at least not under any circumstances. Leading personnel at the top of an organization might be well at ease with existing uncertainties in the form of interpretability constraints. Based on full and unmistakable information may require action leading figures or instances are unwilling to take. A United Nations panel in charge of evaluating UN peacekeeping missions after the disasters of Rwanda and Srebrenica in 1994 and 1995 noted, quote, "The panel recommends that the Secretariat of the United Nations tell the Security Council what it needs to know, not what the Council wants to hear when formulating or changing mission mandates," unquote. In other words, the purposeful exploitation of interpretability constraints may appear in the form of intended ignorance. As soon as, unlike the conventional principal agent theory proposes, the so-called agents are more than willing to provide full information, while the principals are unwilling to receive, let alone mobilize, information out of fear that being informed might imply being forced to act, and that to act may imply to get in trouble. So far, I was talking about uncertainties concerning the past. This is admittedly a rather atypical perspective relative to the conventional perspective that associates the notion of uncertainty with the phenomenon of unpredictability and thus with the future, which is what I will address in the subsequent section of this talk. Here too, one can distinguish purposefully created and purposefully sustained or exploited uncertainties, this time in the form of predictability constraints. Purposefully created predictability constraints are commonplace in the realm of contracts and legislation. The notion of incomplete contracts, prominent in the microeconomic literature, refers to the fact that contracts may be purposefully left vague and unspecific, either because the actual circumstances under which contractual arrangement will become relevant are unpredictable indeed, or because the efforts to make the unpredictable more predictable are just too costly. In both variants, the very incompleteness of the contract makes its actual enforcement unpredictable. Likewise, legislation typically includes clauses granting discretionary leeway to the judiciary and public administration. This type of purposefully created predictability constraints is designed to enable courts and public authorities to adapt their decisions and actions to the actual conditions of the case. Incomplete contracts and the kind of soft law that grants discretionary leeway to courts and public authorities are embedded in a solid institutional environment that mitigates the purposefully created unpredictability to a tolerable degree, since it establishes a kind of firewall between actual unpredictability and sheer arbitrariness. This is different with non-institutional or deinstitutionalized strategies and tactics of purposefully created uncertainties. One such phenomenon is currently being debated, by obvious reasons, under the headline Madman Tactics. Another example is known as frozen conflicts. So-called madman tactics are designed to make one's behavior and decisions incalculable according to conventional wisdom or rationality standards, and thus necessarily unpredictable in an attempt to catch one's opponent by surprise and to weaken his or her position through making an initial tactical disposition obsolete. Former Libyan dictator Muammar al-Gaddafi may be mentioned as a prominent example, along with US President Donald Trump. Gaddafi managed to have his tent erected in the garden of the Élysée Palace in Paris, when the palace itself was inhabited by President Nicolas Sarkozy. Trump managed to erect one of the most brutal dictators of this globe, who murdered even close relatives for the sake of stabilizing his own power. Trump, in other words, managed erecting Kim Jong-un to a well-respected and surprisingly influential figure of international diplomacy. In both cases, purposefully created uncertainty in the form of predictability constraints, to put it mildly, resulted in preliminary diplomatic success. The ultimate fate of Muammar al-Gaddafi is well known, however. The fate of Donald Trump will at least be less brutal. Yet another phenomenon of purposefully created uncertainty in the form of predictability constraints are so-called frozen conflicts. One might say the world is full of them, but just like with the animals of George Orwell's Animal Farm, one might also say that all frozen conflicts are equally frozen, but some are more and some are less frozen than others. And some stand out as specifically critical cases precisely because they are connected to political strategies that create uncertainty by purpose. There's obviously a huge difference between the frozen conflict on the Korean Peninsula and the frozen conflict, if it is one, in Ukraine. Even in the territorial periphery of Russia today, the most ardent and committed entrepreneur of frozen conflicts, the differences are salient. Russia has, according to all evidence, no interest in further escalating the conflict with Georgia over South Ossetia and Abkhazia, or the conflict with Moldova over Transnistria. That is entirely different with Ukraine, where Russia in the east of the country, following a pattern already at display in the Georgian breakaway provinces of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, established a puppet regime whose militias, together with regular Russian forces, exert a permanent threat of destabilization of Ukraine, which accordingly leaves Russia with the discretion over freezing and defreezing the conflict as such, and to use the resulting leverage in the international arena. The frozen conflict phenomenon might be the most plausible example of purposefully created uncertainty in the realm of politics. Just like the madman tactics, using the opportunity to freeze and to defreeze conflicts as political leverage is a strategy that makes purposeful use of a strategy of a state of unpredictability, which in international politics is a high-risk strategy by definition. Conversely, however, strategies that sustain or exploit constrained predictability that exist anyway are in principle of a much more benign nature. At least they have the potential of reducing or mitigating risks if aptly applied. A classic example is what John Rawls has characterized as the inevitable veil of ignorance that conceals the consequences of present-day decisions for complex societies and future generations. in the absence of even the slightest chance to make the consequences of present-day decisions for every segment of society and every cohort of future generations predictable, justice, according to Rawls, should be based on principles of, quote, pure procedural justice, unquote, while distributional justice should be limited to measures that improve the conditions of the least advantaged classes in society. Rather than to make the futile effort to lift the veil of ignorance, Rawls says, we should accept the unpredictability of the specific future consequences of present-day decisions. So the principle and guidelines of those decisions should exclude procedural arbitrariness and the reinforcements of already existing social inequality. A similarly pragmatic approach to the inevitable predictability constraints is the bounded rationality school of thought in organization theory, whose towering figures in the relevant literature are Herbert Simon and James March. The message of their trailblazing contributions to organization theory in the 1950s and 1960s was that managers have to accept the limited capacity of the human brain to process all necessary information for a perfectly rational decision. Rather, they should accept the bounded rationality of organizations as a profoundly helpful mechanism enabling humans to make decisions under the condition of uncertainty, but according to what the written and unwritten rules of a given organization suggest as a satisfying in lieu of a perfect level of rationality. In quite a similar vein, scholars exploring the conditions of institutional adaptability and change have emphasized the necessity of a mutual balance between rigidity and flexibility of organizational structures. While the former guarantee predictability, the latter exploit predictability constraints. One prominent scholar in organization science, Michel Crozier, explicitly addressed what he called zones of uncertainty in formal organizations and characterize them as a structural prerequisite of how power is being mobilized within organizations, bureaucratic organizations in particular. Since rule-bound and strictly hierarchized bureaucratic organizations make almost everything so predictable, the remaining zones of uncertainty, according to Crozier, are fiercely contested among the bureaucrats themselves. Accordingly, Crozier says, the control of zones of uncertainty is the crucial generator of intra-organizational power, which implies that the maintenance of uncertainty as such and exploitation for individual purposes becomes a dominant action strategy in its own right, regardless of whether or not those actions serve the purpose of the organization itself. This may, in turn, imply the politicization of professional issues, both within and outside the world of formal organizations. As soon as power becomes relevant, the discretionary leeway akin to professional decision-making may make professionals corruptible, not in the sense of direct bribery, but rather in the sense of qualifying professional decisions according to what is perceived as politically desirable or political necessities or blunt pressure. Finally, what is typically being exploited in terms of predictability constraints is the relative autonomy of governmental subunits, typically individual authorities, in pursuit of their own institutional logic and agenda. Unlike what conventional wisdom suggests, major bureaucratic apparatuses do enjoy autonomy in the sense that public policies are being developed and implemented in a process of mutual exchange between policymakers and professional experts at the administrative level. Their autonomy and professional expertise is both an asset and a liability as far as the principle of responsible government are concerned. Professional expertise may be used for both loyal commitment to a government's cause. It may, however, also be used and for what in the literature is called bureaucratic politics, in the sense that individual authorities may pursue their own agenda in a spirit of institutional selfishness rather than the public interest. Again, he or she who is involved in bureaucratic politics will be aiming at sustaining and exploiting zones of uncertainty in the form of predictability constraints rather than making governmental action more predictable in the first place. Now that I have delivered a kind of tour de force through the quite a number of illustrations. As far as the four basic categories of intended uncertainty are concerned, you may have realized that the examples I mentioned differ in at least two more dimensions. One is the degree of institutionalization, and another, even more salient one, is the degree of legitimacy and acceptability of consequences. Forced disappearance, to begin with, is a clearly illegitimate, inhumane practice of purposefully created uncertainty, since it is designed to trigger fear and intimidation. Basically, it is terror, barely disguised. By contrast, incomplete contracts or legally granted discretion of public authorities are variants of intended uncertainties whose legitimacy is beyond reasonable doubt. Both types, however, apart from each other, have in common that they appear or are being enforced in a fixed institutional setting. Conversely, madman tactics or individual and collective sense-making strategies are non-institutional in nature. They may, of course, occur in an institutional setting such as formal organizations or bureaucracies or governmental agencies, but that is not their qualifying property. Moreover, madman tactics or frozen conflict strategies are, like I mentioned, hazardous behavioral patterns with a very restricted legitimacy status, since they create uncertainty unnecessarily, while the uncertainty about the conduct, again, of negotiations behind closed doors is an easily acceptable principle that serves a good purpose, which is to reach robust compromises. Plausible as these examples and categorizations may be, they nonetheless may be challenged. Is, for example, the purposeful use of predictability constraints for the sake of enhanced institutional adaptability and change always legitimate and acceptable? After all, it might occur that adaptability is nothing but goal deflection that implies concessions to pressure groups at the expenses of institutional integrity. Likewise, are negotiations behind closed doors always a good thing? After all, it is a style of decision-making that systematically undermines transparency and democratic control. Conversely, is the control of zones of uncertainty for the sake of enhanced power always bad? Couldn't it be characterized as a legitimate technique to keep quasi-sclerotic organizations going, even if that may imply the stabilization of power asymmetries? By the same token, one might argue that even myth-building serves a productive purpose, since it works in support of collective identity and maybe commitment to a common cause. Moreover, shouldn't we acknowledge the psychologically mitigating effects of intended ignorance? After all, it might be a good thing not to know everything and to prevent ourselves from psychological stress and related unwise decisions decisions in the form of overreaction. And even maintenance of frozen conflicts as a source of constant uncertainty may be justified, since, after all, a frozen conflict still saves countless human lives as opposed to open violence. That's a truism when you live in Israel. So, between legitimate and illegitimate types of intended uncertainty, regardless of whether institutionalized or non-institutionalized, there is a kind of gray zone where the legitimacy status depends on the circumstances. But what then can be said about those circumstances? It is, I am stating, about three dimensions. One is the degree of institutionalization, which is in itself of an ambiguous nature as far as the consequences of intended uncertainty are concerned. These consequences, however, represent the second important dimension when it comes to the legitimacy and acceptability of intended uncertainty. What is important is that these two dimensions are subject to human control and agency. Institutions and institutional designs are man-made, and they can be adjusted and changed. Consequences can be anticipated, which impacts on how institutions are being handled and what decisions are being taken. In other words, it is about judgment and leadership, and that is indeed the third dimension of what makes intended uncertainty more or less legitimate and acceptable. More or less legitimate and acceptable. Regardless of whether the subject is the past or the future, whether it is constrained interpretability or constrained predictability, the degree of institutionalization matters. It does matter, however, in various ways. It may aggravate or mitigate illegitimate or unacceptable effects of intended uncertainty. Forced disappearance is typically institutionalized under dictatorships or authoritarian regimes. It is obvious, just like with any other crimes against humanity, that state-sponsored forced disappearance as the most forceful type of institutionalization is much more severe in scale and scope than less intensive or non-existent types of institutionalized forced disappearance. The opposite holds true for negotiations behind closed doors or frozen conflicts. To what extent they are kept under either scrutiny or control depends on the degree of institutionalization of their respective political environment. We just invest more trust in the seriousness and effectiveness of bargaining processes among elected officials that can be held accountable for the ultimate outcome of a bargain than, for example, in a deal between Volkswagen and the German Federal Motor Transport Authority, known as the Kraftfahrtbundesamt, in charge of licensing diesel engines. Accordingly, institutionalization per se is no indicator of the legitimacy or acceptability of intended uncertainty and its consequences, which is why the second dimension matters, that concerns the actual consequences of more or less institutionalized types of intended uncertainty, or put another way, what is at stake. It makes a difference if we are uncertain what our partner or our friends have in store for an upcoming birthday party, or what Donald Trump has in store for the Organization of International Trade Relations. It also makes a difference whether the politicization of professional issues affects the management of a municipal theater or of a municipal hospital, let alone road safety or air traffic control. So it is almost by instinct that we realize that the task at hand and the situation we are facing determines how seriously we take the consequences of intended uncertainty. Which leads us to the third dimension that matters, judgment and leadership. After all, the degree and the nature of institutionalization, as well as the task at hand and the actual situational context, are subject to human judgment and, if necessary, intervention. Institutional arrangements that increase the risk of illegitimate and unacceptable consequences of intended uncertainty can be changed. The consequences themselves can be and have to be contained or neutralized as soon as they turn out to be illegitimate or unacceptable. This is obviously a moral question and accordingly a question of responsible leadership. No matter whether it is political leadership, corporate leadership, civic leadership, or spontaneous leadership in the form of civil courage and initiative. And that leadership may include the necessity to protect the integrity of institutions that constrain illegitimate and unacceptable consequences of basically intended or tolerated uncertainty. To wrap this up, intended uncertainty per se is not a bad thing. Whether it appears in the form of constrained interpretability or in the form of constrained predictability, its consequences might be desirable, legitimate, and acceptable, as well as undesirable, illegitimate, and unacceptable. The challenge, in analytical, normative, and pragmatic terms, is relatively simple but of utmost importance, being aware of the necessity of awareness. Awareness that ignoring, tolerating, or correcting interpretability constraints and/or predictability constraints might be both a matter of principle and a matter of circumstances. And whether sticking to principles, or for the experts, deontology, or pragmatic adjustment to circumstances is the appropriate response remains a matter of normative judgment. And since normative judgment, just in accordance with the classic diagnosis of Immanuel Kant, is intrinsically wedded to the assessment of actual capability, we need to remain aware of the risk that the assessment of necessary capability may corrupt the objective and unfettered judgment of what ought to be and what needs to be done. So we have to take into account a double circle of uncertainty. There is the inner circle of either interpretability constraints or predictability constraints in the first place. And there is the uncertainty that comes both with the appropriateness or inappropriateness of normative judgments about legitimacy and acceptability of the original uncertainty and the assessment of the possibility to do something about it. While the assessment of the original uncertainty is a matter of intellectual judgment, the assessment of the appropriateness and actual possibility of responses is a matter of trust, invested in the integrity and capability of persons, ourselves included, and institutions. Quite admittedly, we in the empirical social sciences do not know very much about the conditions of integrity and capability of persons and institutions when coping with uncertainty is at stake. The reason is obvious and simple. We just haven't paid attention. And that is why this workshop is so important. Therefore, thank you very much again for having both of us, Luisa and me. That was it. Thanks. Okay.
Thank you for this presentation. The floor is open for questions before going to the party. Any comments?
You got it. Yeah.
Is there a difference in your mind between ignorance and uncertainty?
Yeah.
It seems to me that many of the conditions that you were describing have to do with creating, maintaining, institutionalizing ignorance. In my intuitive thinking about this, there's a deep psychological difference, although they are related, between not knowing and being uncertain.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the core questions, obviously, and I was pondering whether to address it explicitly or not. So it is. I decided to do what I call the tour de force here in order to explain that in various strands of the literature and in various ways, the problem of uncertainty is being addressed. So that is why I used a different kind of terminology. That's why I was talking about interpretability constraints and predictability constraints in the sense that in principle it is focusing on impulse that you would like to predict, that you would like to be able to properly interpret. So, but I inserted some examples that I hope are kind of counterintuitive. So when it comes to the frozen conflict phenomenon, for example, so it's basically treated in the international relations literature as a risky thing. Huh? So, but by obvious reasons, I mentioned Israel. So it's a permanent frozen conflict, but still you live with that, and more or less. And or likewise, the phenomenon of intended ignorance. Huh? So if you know you could know, but you are nonetheless reluctant to make efforts to know exactly, so leaving something in the cloud by purpose, this is something that I think could be appropriately called intended uncertainty, because you remain uncertain. It always remains your decision whether or not to dig deeper, so to speak.
But if you had to separate ignorance and uncertainty, how would you do that?
Well, I don't know, but not right now. So the impulse that made me pick this topic was many years ago I wrote an article with the title "Successful Failure." I mentioned some of my own papers here, but and also unsystematically. So. That was about intended ignorance, in the sense that you just you could know, but you don't want to know. And I built that, inserted this here, in a different wording. So I said the inverse principal agent model. Yeah? So the conventional assumption is that principals always want to know exactly. But there are instances and circumstances where that is just not true. So where they have a strong interest in remaining ignorant, and the consequence of that is that the entire organization is necessarily left in a state of uncertainty, because basically you want so-called principal, the people at the top of the organization, to be aware at least of the most important things that happen in your organization, and if they are determinedly ignorant, they cannot make the relevant decision about that. Yeah? So somehow, I mean, this is clearly something we need to discuss. I mean, this is why workshops like this one are being organized.
More questions?
Maybe something before. Would you have a case examples for unintended certainty or for intended certainty, sort of to complement and would you say that, I mean, you give a very wide range of examples.
Yeah.
Would you say that intended uncertainty is the rule?
Well, there is no such rule, I guess. Okay? So, unintended certainty does exist. So, if you become aware of something you don't want to know something about, so something bad that has happened, maybe just the state of your bank account. So you might have been unwise enough to open the ledger of a bank and you are certain about what the status of your bank account is. So this is unintended certainty. Yeah? And, well, I could give other examples of immoral behavior. In a marriage, for example, they rather would prefer to be ignorant and uncertain about certain things, and you are, well, unintendedly aware that something happened that you would have preferred not to know. And as a thumb rule, I mean, we discuss all this because the thumb rule always is you would like to be certain about things and about phenomena, and you would like to get as much information as you can get at low cost.
You actually made the case that very often we don't want to do, but yeah, the reason not to want.
Yeah, that is what I would define the innovative character of my contribution. So this is just the deviance from the rule. And so this is, of course, very pretentious, but I do think that that's why I said the thumb rule. So if you do have a thumb rule, there are the exceptions. And well, of course, I try to talk about the exceptions and not about the rule.
It seems to be following back on what Igor said, that ignorance is key.
Yeah.
Yeah. The relationship.
Yeah. No, I just, quite honestly, I just thought this is for that kind of talk, well, again, not in the core of my field, too ambitious. Yeah? So, and it would have been very vague and abstract and purely theoretical. I mean, this is theoretical enough, I hope, I think. So that's why I decided not to address this particular and obvious puzzle. Well, what's the difference between ignorance and uncertainty, and the difference between intended ignorance and intended uncertainty?
But I can't be certain about something that's false, or that's not. As far as you're concerned, I can't be certain about something that's correct.
Well, the thing is, if you don't know, you can't be certain. And if you do know, you're uncertain about how much you know and if it's sufficient what you know. So it's
Can we know ever that there's ever certainty in principle?
Well, you may know exactly that you don't know enough. So this is quite the usual state of our mind. Yes, I agree. But you can never be sure, according to all experience, how much of a much you don't know. Yeah? So this might be called uncertainty.
Yeah? Maybe it's a very trivial question, but I wonder with this madman tactics. Mm. You mentioned Trump. I remember, I think Nixon also did it as well already, if I'm not completely wrong. And if I go back in history, I think some Roman emperors did the same thing. So I just wonder, is it a very ancient tactic to become a leader?
That might be. So I'm not an historian, but you think, of course, of classic examples. You might think of Nero or other crazy Roman emperors, of course. And so, I mean, the interesting case would not be the Nero case, but it would be where the madman tactics were successful, obviously. And nothing really springs to my mind. So let's see what happens with Kim Jong-un and the subsequent meetings and negotiations and so on and so forth. And what will happen, I mean, today will be announced a meeting between Putin and Trump in a couple of weeks from now. So let's see what is in store, for example, for Ukraine, whether Trump will sell Ukraine for a certain bargain, as he almost sold South Korea. I mean, this is exaggerated, I know, but he made concessions no other president would have made to North Korea, and this is, well, the opposite what everyone would have expected. So this, there might be historic examples which I just don't know.
I just wonder, would you say that people like Hitler or Stalin also used this tactic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously so. Yeah? I mean, Hitler was, take the Hitler-Stalin pact. That was madman tactics, a classic case. So he caught everybody by surprise, and they divided Poland for the fourth time. And the Soviet Union invaded Poland September the 17th, just like the German forces had invaded Poland 17 days before. So that was totally unexpected. And it did caught the British and the French by surprise, very much so.
Thank you. This was very thought-provoking. You closed on the statement that uncertainty in itself doesn't have to be a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking about this right after you said it, and I can think of a number of examples where certainty is a bad thing. In, for example, conspiracy theories. You don't know what's going on and who's responsible, but somebody connects the dots and says, it was an inside job. It had to be the Americans that brought down the towers.
Mm-hmm.
Prejudice. You have one negative experience with somebody belonging to a group, so the entire group is tainted from now on.
Mm-hmm.
Ideologies. It's all about class struggle. It's all about whatever, social Darwinism, whatever. So these ideologies or sets of ideas essentially create certainty or sense of certainty where uncertainty actually prevails and exists. But would you go as far as to say that we should embrace uncertainty or ignorance? Is that something that you actually...
Well, yeah. This is again, a very, very important question. This is basically what I wanted to address in the last part of my talk. So the normative aspect, and I said one has to realize what is at stake. So what are the actual consequences? There are many, many instances in which we can just afford uncertainty. We just don't care, and we know, we have a feeling that it doesn't really matter. But we never can be sure. We remain uncertain to what extent we are really able to afford that. And the ability to make that distinction, I mean, this is a classic case of Kantian judgment. So being able to judge, being able to make the difference and to act accordingly or to take decisions accordingly. So there is no such general rule to which extent exactly we can accept and afford accepting uncertainty, but the necessity and the awareness of the necessity of judgment is very important in its own right. So that is basically what I tried to say at the very end of my talk.
Yeah, it runs a little bit counter to the enlightened ambition to craft, you know, definitive explanations for things and figure out how.
Yeah, but yeah.
But from a moral and political consequence point of view, I see all the negative consequences.
I believe I see your point. I mean, it is, especially of course in our profession, it is a delicate problem, because we are being paid for, and we're very, very ambitious to remove every single bit of uncertainty. So it is. It just comes with the profession, so fortunately there is such a thing like division of labor in society. So we are just a group, and we are just one factor in a deeply, deeply echeloned and complex society. And it's just our job. So it might be other people's job to take care of the zones of uncertainty. Yeah? But it is certainly not our job, unless you are, but I don't say what I wanted to say. I wanted to say, well, unless you are a constructivist, but that is my own individual idiosyncrasy.
Okay, do I see any more questions? Everybody is in for the cocktails. Thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.